Today, it's such a great honor for us to have Jitun Ma Tenzin Palmo as our guest, as one of the most remarkable Buddhist figures of our time. It's really great for us to have you share your wisdom and experience. And through these conversations, we hope we can enhance the pursuit of meaning and spiritual purpose of life, which I see you as an epitome of some of such bold and visionary spiritual pursuit and adventure. So thank you for joining us. And I normally begin by asking our guests to share a bit about your spiritual background by telling us when you encountered the teachings on Buddha nature, from whom, and what kind of impression or memory do you have of it?
Oh, dear me, Karma, I really have no idea. I really don't know. I do recall very much the first time I read about bodhisattvas, because up to that point, I had only heard about arahats, who I didn't like very much. And so when I heard about bodhisattvas, then that was a huge revelation and the aspiration that that's what I wanted. I wanted to be a bodhisattva. I didn't want to be an arahat. But Buddha nature, I don't know. I had always, since I was a small child, very small child, I had believed that we are innately perfect, that our true nature is perfect, and that we have lost sight of our true nature. And that therefore we had to keep coming back again and again and again until we discovered our innate perfection. So therefore, throughout my childhood and teenage years, I was searching for what is perfection and how do we reach it? And so it was, when I heard, I must have heard about Buddha nature at some time, it just, to my mind, synced in with this idea of our innate perfection, that that's what we were looking for. And I mean, that's what we're looking for. What are we here for, you know?
What could have made you believe as a child that we are innately perfect? Do you think that was something that you inherited from your previous lifetimes or your upbringing in this life? How do you explain it?
Oh, I think it's definitely some scars from past lives, because I mean, Britain, London in the 1940s and 50s was not very, clued in about innate perfection. And the Church of England, which we nominally belong to, you know, Christianity unfortunately talks more about our sinful nature than our divine nature, our innate divinity. So I don't think I could have got it from anywhere there. I remember asking my mother, telling my mother this is what I thought and what did she think? And she said that she thought it sounded very sensible. And I thought, yes, it does. And so that's what I believe. But I don't remember meeting anyone else who thought like that. I tried. Priests, teachers, anybody I thought who would know, and they all said, well, you have to be good. Some people said, you have to be good, you have to be kind. And even at that age, I thought, well, yes, of course, you have to be good, you have to be kind, but that is not it. It is something far beyond all that. But what is it that is our true nature that we don't see? So that's why my spiritual quest was always a quest towards Buddha nature without even knowing that's what I was doing.
Can you tell us a little more about this quest, the sort of milestones you went through discovering your sort of Buddha nature or that innate perfection that you...
West, was it very difficult in those days. I mean, nothing, you know, Asian spirituality was practically unknown. Unlike nowadays where everybody's, you know, practicing mindfulness and meditation, it's mainstream. In those days, nobody had even heard of anything like that, even yoga. And so I was looking everywhere. I mean, I'm reading Dostoevsky, who is quite spiritual. And then I got into the existentialists like Sartre, Camus, Kierkegaard. They understood dukkha, but they didn't understand the cause of dukkha, what to speak of the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. That was their problem, very depressing. And looking everywhere, all these religions, I tried, but all the religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, all are based on the idea of a creator God outside of ourselves, who is basically pulling all the strings and at the end of it all judging us on our performance. And I just didn't believe it. I just felt, no, that's not like that. And so it wasn't until I came to Buddhism, which of course is non-theistic, that it all just made so much sense. Everything, including, of course, karma and rebirth and the final liberation. I couldn't believe it. The Buddha was saying all the things I had always believed in. And he showed a path. He didn't just say, this is the nature of reality. He showed us how we ourselves could tread that path to the realization of that reality and the freedom of the mind, which was extraordinary, especially in the UK in those days, back in the 50s.
Jitsun Ma, when you think of innate perfection now, that perfect innate Buddha nature, how do you describe it? How would you put it? I know, of course, you would have received a lot of teachings on it from your teachers coming from the Gaju tradition, but you have also gone through a lot of experiences of it through very long retreats and meditation. So if you were to communicate to a general audience, describe Buddha nature from your experience, how would you describe that inner perfection now?
Well, I usually say, compare it to the sky. Mm. Or space, because how can we say? I mean, space is there. It's always there, but we don't see it, right? It's like if you look in the sky, you see the clouds, you see the rainbows, but we maybe it's covering up. We don't see the actual sky. Or if we walk into a room, we see the furniture, we see the decorations, we see the people. But we don't notice that what is really there is space. And so this space, you can't see it, you can't taste it, you can't touch it, you can't grasp it. But everything, it's everywhere. I mean, where is space not? And unlike what appears to us to be very solid articles, which divide themselves and are static, space interconnects with everything. So this is like the nature of the mind. It is this innate non-dual knowing of the mind, you know, that is always with us, but we don't recognize it. I think that this is the very good thing in Mahamudra Dzogchen, that they emphasize that it's not something we have to gain. It's not a seed that we have to grow. It's already there in its completeness, its own splendor, but we just don't see it. Like, as they say, we don't see our eyelashes because they're too close. So we get caught up in all our thinking, all our emotions, all our memories and anticipations. And we don't examine that which knows. And so this is, to my mind, it's the essence of this, is that it's completely pure because there is no contamination there. And like pure space, it can get polluted and airplanes fly through it, birds fly through it, but they don't leave a trace. It's just, it comes and it goes. And so that open, spacious clarity, luminous clarity to my mind, empty in the sense of allowing everything and being open to everything to appear and to then disappear. So this is, I think, very important for people to recognize that it's not something out there somewhere. It's not like, you know, climbing up a steep mountain. It's so close to us that we don't see it. That's why we have to go through all this other stuff, you know, all our mundros and all the nyenpas and all the recitations and all the this and that, in order to come back to where we have never actually left and recognize it. Because it's all about recognition.
But Jitsun Ma, now, when you use the analogy of the space, it definitely gives this very clear idea of openness, of freedom, of liberation, of this sort of total emptiness of elaborations or constructions. But then Buddha nature also has that fullness of wisdom and compassion, isn't it? That people shouldn't see the inner perfection.
It's empty. That's why it can contain everything. I mean, otherwise it wouldn't be able to take it. But you know, I mean, it's not empty. You know very well, it's not empty in the sense of nothing. It's empty in the sense of openness, that it can include everything. So yes, its expression is compassion and clear seeing, this wisdom, which is a clarity of view, uncluttered by the ego and our conceptual thinking. I mean, I often say, when people say, it all sounds very vague, just look at the really genuine lamas, how they are. And they don't have to say, I mean, like when, for example, when the Tibetans first came out, and the great lamas like Dzogchen Rinpoche, Dogo Khenso Rinpoche, 16th Karmapa, and so all the great lamas, they all came out at that time, and they didn't know English. And all the foreigners that met them didn't know Tibetan. So there was no communication. But one didn't need communication. They could just sit there smiling and offering you a cup of tea, and it was enough. They didn't have to say anything. Just looking at them, you knew, this is it. This is our human potential. And I don't know, I mean, everyone was thinking, I don't know what you believe in, but whatever it is, I want some. And that's how it started. You know, this interest in Tibetan Buddhism was because of the practitioners themselves embodying all those qualities which we could otherwise only read about. Yes, it's true. It's there. It's not just Milarepa and Guru Rinpoche. It's right here, right now.
So
and this, that's the point, karma. As you know very well, they're extremely alive, extremely awake, right? I mean, that's the whole point. It's not like you're sitting there, you know, spaced out and everybody's just worshiping you. I mean, they built monasteries, they organized their monks, they got everything, you know, printed books and had so much outreach at that time when they first came to India and to Nepal and probably to Bhutan, like Degu Khyentse Rinpoche. They were very active, but at the same time, with that air of open, spacious relaxation and clarity of vision and humor. I think humor is also an important part. They love to laugh.
So the realization of this open, free, innate Buddha nature comes with this ineffable, awesome presence and this lot of benevolent activities. Now, we are in a world where, you know, there's a lot of sort of self-centricity. A lot of people actually even believe that altruism is wrong. There's this wicked world syndrome, negativity bias, a lot of moral and philosophical egoism. In such a world, how can we convince people that there is this innate goodness?
Well, I think for a start, it helps an enormous amount for them even to hear about it, because everyone is becoming so depressed and stressed because they are told that all these negative qualities are innate, that it's your real nature is to be aggressive, your real nature is to be selfish and hedonistic and greedy and all these other things. That's who we really are when you get down to it, you know? And then how utterly depressing that is. No wonder people just despair. But if they're told, no, that's not true at all. Wisdom going back thousands of years has affirmed, and people realize that ultimately we have basic goodness. Ultimately, our nature is love, is luminosity, is intelligence and wisdom. Inherently, we are good, and we can realize that. That's what meditation is for, to help us to come back and see for the first time our true nature and not identify with everything which is not our true nature, which can be cleaned away. That's the pollution around the silver pot, but it's not the silver pot. So clean away that pollution and you've got a beautiful, totally immaculate, object there, which is our true nature, which at the same time, of course, connects us with everything. I mean, this view of our innate aggression and selfishness separates us from everything. That's why people are so lonely and disenfranchised, from alienated. Whereas to recognize that our nature is more like space, then we are all interconnected with everything. Isn't that wonderful? Mm. All living beings, the whole of nature, we are all interconnected. Then even hearing that can help people. You know, just knowing that actually millions of people believe that. And not only do they believe it and have always believed it, but they can realize it. There's a path towards recognizing our genuine nature and not identifying so much with our false nature. Mm. I think that's that's what people need to hear. Mm. We're not sinful. Mm. We're just deluded. Mm.
So in disseminating such message, in spreading this message of natural goodness, and the Buddhist teachings in general, you have been at the forefront of transmitting Buddhism away from the Himalayan sources to the Western world. What can we do better? What improvements can we make in terms of transmitting such teachings like Buddha nature or other forms of Buddhist teachings to benefit a greater number of people, especially in the Western world?
Well, that's a huge question, Karma. I think that it would be helpful if we didn't also export the problems in Himalayan Buddhism, in Tibetan Buddhism, including, as we all know, patriarchy, hierarchy, sectarianism, and a basic feudal outlook. Mm. I'm not sure the West needs that. And I don't think that's what the Buddha had in mind.
So the cultural baggage that comes with the Buddhist teachings have to be left behind. The cultural baggage, I call them the cultural baggage, things like patriarchy, the incarnation institution, the
guru. I mean, if people like that in them, then okay. But that is not what Vajrayana is really all about. You know, I mean, if we consider how Vajrayana was when it was in India, then it was something which was very small. You had the teacher and a very, very few, very close disciples who he really took care of and trained. And it was at the same time always somewhat outside of society, because it was, as we know, you know, so much of what went on was not part of the monastic and scholastic training of those days. So it was always on the outside, only for those who were truly, truly devoted to breaking through all the confines. But when it went to Tibet and then later to Bhutan and elsewhere, then of course it became the, you know, national religion. And that really wasn't what it was all about. Really, you know, so then one guru has hundreds, maybe thousands of disciples. Well, then how can he help each one individually? I mean, there's no way. And so it all becomes institutionalized. I mean, even in the monasteries, they never saw their head lama except sitting up on a throne. I mean, you know, there was no real intimate interrelationship between the big lamas and the ordinary monks. Anyway, the thing is that what I personally feel that people need to do is to, I think that Mahamudra Dzogchen is more helpful for most people, along with bodhicitta, because it's something we can take into our daily life. I mean, most people have not got the opportunities to go away for years at a time doing guided retreats and so forth. But what they do have is education. And with that, they can really look at the teachings, understand them, and then really integrate them not just into their daily sitting, but also into their everyday life, their family, their work, people that they meet around. They can adapt the teachings and recognize that daily life is our teaching, you know, all the paramitas, learning how to be more generous, more kind, more present and aware, not just when we're sitting on our cushion, but, you know, at all times, to try to have that sense of inner presence, inner space. I mean, this, I think Westerners could definitely benefit from, even if they're not Buddhists. Learning how to become the masters of our own mind instead of the slave. For which we need the, you know, always, all day, every day.
When we look at the transmission of Buddhism, especially Tibetan Buddhism, to the West, currently we see some sort of scientific pathways, such as the Mind and Life Institute efforts to sort of make it more authentic and acceptable through scientific support. Then you also see, in the case of mindfulness, how you have the clinical, medical, and therapeutic use being adopted to spread it. And there are some people, I think we both know Stephen Batchelor, who also talks about a very secular form of Buddhism. So there are differences, but I'm just wondering how the Denji, that your tradition, the Drukpa Kagyu tradition, embodies the true sort of lineage, the essential transmission. Would the current sort of Tibetan Buddhist regime work for a Western disciple or student, like Dungyan Rose? You have been through 12 years of retreat. Is that the best way for people to take up this Denji, the true transmission? Or what would work better for an ordinary Westerner?
I think it helps a lot if, well, I mean, it also depends on your motivation. You know, I mean, how much one has really dedicating, how much the Dharma is at the center of one's life, you know. But I think that, you know, the chances of many people going through a really thorough training in the Tibetan style is rare. I mean, for example, in our nunnery, we have a retreat center and with about now 10 nuns in it. And most of them have done 12 years retreat. They're training to become Togden Ma. But I mean, two of them who came in just over a year ago said they have now finished 5 sets of Mundro. And I mean, that kind of dedication, I mean, it's not just finishing one mundra, but 5 rounds of mundra within a year. It's that kind of total focus is, I don't know how many Western people would do it. I mean, some will, but it's not ever going to be a major. So I think that more important than that would be teaching people how to keep the basic view, the Dzogchen view, Anamaha Mudra view, along with bodhicitta throughout the day. And transform, bring the Dharma into the center of our life instead of just in the periphery when we have a bit of time. Because that's what we need. It's to transform the mind, you know, the mind, turn the mind to the Dharma, as they always say. That's what we need. So that everything we do, everybody we meet, is our Dharma practice. Which so, we could do, because it doesn't take time. It just takes application.
And bringing Mahamudra, Dzogchen, awareness into the daily life. I actually want to ask you now a personal question. I mean, you have spent such a long time in a retreat as a recluse, and then you left your retreat after about 12 years, spent time in Italy, Assisi, and you have sort of started to live two lives simultaneously almost. While being a very devoted Mahabuddha practitioner, you were also back very fully into the Western high culture, sort of turned from a cave dweller to a jet setter, now trying to combine asceticism with sensuality and solitude with sociability. Now you have also this task of running a nunnery. So how easy is it to balance these? To bring awareness into daily life, I think for most people will be very difficult if you, after all your practice, finds it tricky to balance. So I want to ask you how you manage.
Well, you know, Karma, wherever we go, whether we're in solitude or in the midst of crowds, we take our mind with us, right? So either we are aware of the mind, or we are not aware of the mind. I mean, the mind can be every bit as wild and distracted, let me assure you, in isolation. And it can be very clear and focused in the midst of many. It doesn't really depend on where you are. It depends on our ability to maintain our awareness under all circumstances. And sometimes very challenging circumstances alert us more than when it appears that externally everything is very conducive. I mean, as you know, I mean, the saying of, you know, body in the cave, mind in the bazaar, right? I mean, that's how it can be. When there's no external entertainment, then the mind, you know, clicks in and brings up its own entertainment program. Mm. So whether one is out to the side or whether one is in, you know, in a retreat, the question is always, do we observe the mind? Or as Mingyur Rinpoche says, do we get lost? I think that's a very useful way of putting it. Are we lost or are we aware?
Mm. So in terms of observing the mind and also turning any circumstances into a catalyst for practice, I want to again ask you this. In your book, you talk about silk versus sandpaper to polish a piece of wood. You're 12 years in the retreat. Sometimes when I think about 12 years you spent, I also think about Asanga's time worshiping Maitreya and how after so many years, he actually didn't get a vision of Maitreya until he went out and saw this old dog with the maggot in the wood, and out of compassion, he sort of tries to help the dog, and that's when he really sees Maitreya. So in Asanga's case, it was really that compassion that removed much of his obscuration. In your case, now you left this retreat life of a recluse and then went on to be an institution builder of sort and a globetrotter. Which of these two is better in terms of refining your sort of meditation experience or your spiritual transformation?
You know, Karma, I think both are useful. Mm. I mean, when I came out of retreat, I went to Italy, to Assisi, to the hills above Assisi. And I tried very hard to go back into retreat again. Someone started building a house, then there were some ownership problems and they had to dismantle it. I went into a retreat in a very remote place and became so ill I could hardly move and I had to crawl across the ground. I tried retreat somewhere else and then again, tremendous obstacles. There were so many obstacles to being in retreat that I said to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, okay, if I'm not meant to do retreat, then what? I have devoted my whole life to Buddha Dhamma Sangha. What do you want me to do?
Mm.
And the answer came, go back to India. So then at first I thought it was to go back to teach English to my Lama Kamsa Rinpoche, who at that time, the Yangtze was 12 years old. So I went back and was teaching him. And then there was a meeting of all the Drukpa Khadju Lamas. And during that, they said to me, look, we have nothing for women, so you start a nunnery. And I remembered that the previous Kamtro had said, I want you to start a nunnery. And so I thought, that's it. That's what I'm meant to do. Mm. And then truly, I thought, how? I'm not a Lama. I'm not even a Tibetan. You can't give talks if no one asks you. How am I going to start? I've never lived in a nunnery. I have no idea how nunneries are run. Where am I going to get the nuns? Where am I going to get the money? Where are we going to get anything? I have no idea how to start. I just know this is what I need to do now. And so then I looked at this tanka of Jetsun Dorma, of Tara. And I said, okay, lady, if you want this nunnery, you do it. I will be your front person, but it's your nunnery. You've got to get it together, because I have not a clue how to start. It's all yours. And she did. She really did. She sent the right people, she sent money, she sent the land, she sent the nuns, she sent everything. And so it's all in the hands of Tara. It's really not much to do with me. But as a result, I ran around the world a few times, and I'm very happy for this lockdown situation. A good excuse to stay put.
Yes, but I'm pretty sure Tara is working through you. How is the nunnery going? Can you tell us a bit about it?
It's going splendidly. This nunnery is for, of course, for Tibetans, but now not so many Tibetans because they don't come out from Tibet anymore. They're not allowed out. But we have about 15 Tibetans, but the majority of the nuns are from the border regions. Ladakh and Zanskar, Kinur, Lahul, Spiti, Bhutan, Sikkim, Arunachal Pradesh, Nepal. Mm. And they study, they have a 12-year study program, including 2 years of Tantra. And they also study ritual. They're very good, especially in church. They do a two-month retreat, every silent retreat every year. And they're also learning some Kundal Cham, Dakini dances. They're very accomplished now. I mean, when 20 years ago, nuns were so overlooked and neglected and nobody took any notice of them. They had so little confidence, very low self-esteem. Nowadays, nuns are so different. Even in Bhutan, nuns have come like anything thanks to Dr. Tashi Zangmo and others. And the Queen Mother, of course, has been wonderful. And nuns are coming up, you know. And I think, to my mind, this is an enormous gift to the Dharma. You know, nobody loses, everybody gains. And so the nun is doing fine. The nuns are very happy to be in lockdown mode. They don't go out. Very few visitors come in. They're very strong as a community. Now we have about maybe 120 nuns. And they're all studying, or some of them, the graduates are teaching. Now most of our teachers are nuns. And they're doing very well. And the Himalayan people are lovely. And they all get along very harmoniously and are a great inspiration. Also, they're very happy, which is always, I feel, a good sign.
Well, so thank you. Thank you for starting the nunnery, being an instrument or channel of Tara for this wonderful work. Indeed, the conditions of nuns, I think, in all parts of the Himalayas have got a lot better. Probably Denju Gatse Ling is the only Drupakaji nunnery outside of Bhutan. I'm not sure. But no, I haven't shared with you.
Tokamitaba, where His Holiness
Gyamang Drukpa. Oh, yes, of course, of course. Yes. 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 Amitabha.
The Drupakaji tradition lives with the nuns. He doesn't live with his monks.
Indeed. Yes, I totally forgot about Amitabha. But I didn't share this with you. I was also made to run a nunnery in the 1990s, Shukseb Nunnery in Dharamsala. So I fully appreciate how difficult the situation of the nuns, particularly the political nuns from Tibet, had to undergo then. A lot of things have changed now and got better. But this leads me to another sort of aspect of your life, more of activism. Now that, in fact, if I quote you, you say, "I have made a vow to attain enlightenment in the female form, no matter how many lifetimes it takes." So you have been a very vocal advocate female spiritual or spiritual equality between the male and female genders. Advocate of better opportunities, more recognition of women in Buddhism. How is that work going? Are you happy when you look back at last 30 years or so of your work?
Oh, yes. I mean, actually, I would say that in the last 30 years, the status of nuns has basically taken a quantum leap. I mean, beyond anything we could have hoped for so quickly. And I will say that this is also very much on account of the support of the monks. Without their help, we could not have done it, you know, because they have been so willing to teach and train the nuns and to pass on their knowledge to the nuns with such openness and encouragement that the nuns have been able to take that and go forward with that. And so now, I mean, we have Geshe Mas, we have Kenmos. We hope soon there will be Geylang Mas. And we are really, the sky's the limit as far as nuns are concerned nowadays. They really, really have transformed even their own perception of what they can accomplish. Now they think they can do everything, and they can. But this is also due to the encouragement of the lamas and the monks who have really been enormously helpful. And we are very, very grateful for that.
So beyond the individual lives or the conditions of nuns, even as a community, when you look at even some of the doctrinal teachings, some of the received traditions, as you mentioned earlier, there is a strong patriarchal element. You know, from Vinaya all the way to Vajrayana, it's a very male-centric system. Do you think those things are also changing and we'll see more changes coming in the near future?
Well, we hope so. I mean, obviously, you always have to ask yourself, well, who wrote the books? And we all know who wrote the books, and it wasn't the girls. Mm-hmm. And so mostly you're hearing the male voice. And the male perception of the feminine. And so therefore, of course, it's somewhat distorted. But, you know, nowadays, for example, in the West, many of the top scholars and teachers and meditation instructors are female. And nobody even questions it. You know, I mean, they have as many male students as female students. They just, you know, if you have the qualifications, you're invited to make your contribution. So I think that this is the way it will go from now on. And even in the Tibetan, very strict Tibetan traditional view, at least certain lamas' daughters now are coming on and starting to teach and have had very, very good training first. And now, like Jetsun Jamyang Palmo, the daughter of Bero Kensi Rinpoche, and also the daughter of Sokni Rinpoche, and of course, Khandro Rinpoche, who everybody knows. I mean, yes, you have to be the daughter of some lama, but nonetheless, they also have the training and the good karma to be in that particular family. And now they have the confidence to, you know, to become teachers in their own rights. So it's changing. It is changing. I mean, one cannot, you know, say that things have stayed the same. It's positive.
Wonderful. Let us turn to the audience and take a few questions. I think there are quite a number of questions. Marcus, will you read the questions out or should I?
Yes, there's quite a number of questions coming in from Facebook as well as on Zoom here. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Great. So one of the questions is about being a layperson and what your advice is for beginning to understand Buddha nature and what are the important steps as a lay person to take to move towards actualizing Buddha nature.
Well, I mean, personally, I always think lay person or nun or monk, so what? You know, the mind doesn't change that much just because you shave your head and wear robes. The same question is to know the mind. I mean, because for all of us, our problem is that we get caught along by our thinking and swept along and emerged in our thinking like a huge river. And we never, like a fish swimming in the ocean, it never asks itself, what is water? So likewise, we swim in an ocean of thought and emotion, and we never ask ourselves, what is a thought? And I think this is very important for anyone who is really serious about understanding and actualizing the Dharma within themselves, is to really look at their own mind. And that is nothing to do with your monastic status or lay status, I mean, or male or female, who cares? The point is, what is the mind? What is a thought? And the only way we can answer that is not by reading books or listening to lamas, but by looking at our own mind. And then learning how to cultivate through that the awareness. I mean, everybody, Atisha, Milarepa, the Buddha, Guru Rinpoche, everybody said the essence of practice is to observe the mind. And that is normally what we don't do. We are swept along by the mind, but we don't step out and observe it. Seeing thought, not as me and mine. And if we can learn how to do that, then we gradually really begin to understand the mind. We're no longer the slaves of our mind. We are in control of the mind. And from that, then it goes deeper and deeper into the non-dualistic levels of back to Buddha nature. But if we don't get our conceptual dualistic mind, you know, if we don't tame that, then I don't think that even if we get glimpses of our Buddha nature, it won't stabilize. And how to stabilize it is to have, you know, like shamatha, vipassana, and then from that, the mind is workable and flexible, and we're able to deal with it. So this is for everybody. It doesn't have to do with being any particular, you know, who you are, where you are, to learn how to become the master of your own mind, tame the mind, and then to open up the heart. This is so important, especially in the world, to really recognize that every single being that we meet, every living being that we meet, not just humans, in their heart would rather feel okay than not feel okay. I mean, everybody, no matter who, it would rather feel nice, you know, okay about themselves. And they don't want to be depressed. They don't want to be upset. They don't want to feel miserable. They would like to be happy. And just as I would rather be happy than miserable, all beings would rather be happy than miserable. So again, to, you know, be there for people, be kind, be generous, be patient. All these qualities needed on the path. Other people are helping us. You know, I mean, the whole Lojong is about taking difficult people and recognizing how they help us to develop qualities which we wouldn't be able to develop if we didn't meet difficult people. So in that way, whether you're a layperson or a monastic, the thing is to learn how to deal skillfully with our thoughts and our emotions and transform our negative into something positive. I mean, one could go on like this forever, but I mean, basically the point is to deal with the mind.
Wonderful. Thank you. There's a lot of different questions coming in, but many of them have to do with practical questions about practice and wondering about advice you could give to people who are practicing. You know, I'm going to try to summarize. Just there are so many questions coming in. Basically, people are asking for advice about daily practice and what can they do practically to connect Buddha nature and maybe also compassion, since you were just talking about that. Can you speak more to that? Any particular practices people should do?
Well, obviously, it's very useful to have some time for formal practice. I mean, it doesn't have to be vast stretches of time, even 10 minutes, 20 minutes of sitting and just, you know, just relaxing and being one with the mind, you know, just the whole point is to develop our ability to be aware. This mindful awareness is so essential throughout the day, and it can be cultivated when we sit. And then when we get that feeling of just knowing, of that sense of being aware and present, to bring that into our daily life as much as possible, but with an open, loving heart, not to just make it, you know, sometimes mindfulness makes people kind of remote and it's sort of cut off from people, you know, watching that themselves all the time. It makes themselves too self-conscious. This is not like that. This is just this very open, spacious sense of presence, but with a very open heart towards all beings that we meet. That we can do all the time, anywhere. And if we have the opportunity to do retreats, even just a few days with a good teacher in a group situation, that's also very helpful for people, because they get the guidance and at the same time the discipline of sitting with others and the charged atmosphere of sitting with others rather than just sitting by themselves. So if you have a sangha that you can go and sit with, you know, occasionally, even once or twice a week, that also can be very encouraging, very helpful for people. But if you don't have that, then just, you know, sit by yourself and imagine all the Buddhism bodhisattvas sitting with you, and you have your own virtual sangha there.
Perfect. Wonderful. There are many other questions, but let me jump to one. You mentioned the Khandro Cham that many of the nuns are practicing and becoming very skilled at the Khandro Cham. Someone's thanking you for even mentioning it, but also others are asking, what is that? Can you explain what the dances are?
Okay. Yeah, very easy. Khandro is the Tibetan for Dakini. Cham is a ritual dancing. So the nuns, we requested the Gyawang Drukpa, who's the head of the Drukpa Kagyu tradition, that some of our nuns could learn these Dakini dances from his nuns. So he invited them to go to Nepal, a group of them, and they studied with his nuns. And he also gave a number of the elaborate costumes, Dakini costumes, which they wear. And since then they've come back, of course, and they have also taught many others. Now about 40 or 50 of our nuns know how to do these dances. So when any big lama, like the Karmapa or some big occasion like inaugurations and things like this, then the nuns perform the dances. There are two dances, one with 5 nuns, one with 21 nuns, no, 16 nuns. But now also we're doing it because no lamas are coming, we're all in lockdown and we don't want the nuns to forget the dances. Now we have made a tradition that they will perform them on what is called Club of Duchen, which is the day commemorating when the Buddha came down from heaven after having spent the rainy season teaching Dharma to his mother and other deities in one of the heavens. So that's a very, very special day in the nunnery. And so now they're also going to include doing the Dakini dances.
Wonderful. There's a question from Facebook from Sonam Chuki. She says, "Dear Jetsun Mala, you are an infinite inspiration to us girls and women, especially in the Himalayan regions like Bhutan, Tibet, Ladakh, Sikkim, and Nepal. How can women and girls formulate our own homegrown Buddhist-inspired feminism to elevate the status of female, genuine women's empowerment and gender equality? What do you think about 21 Tara as a model to serve the sentient beings in general and uplift women's position?"
Well, yeah, I think it's a very good idea if women come together. You know, we're in Mongolia, there are no nunneries, but what there are associations of lay women who come together and are actually, they are called by the Mongolian word for dakini, and they wear special costumes when they learn dakini dancing, and they also are excellent in chur. And they all come together to meditate and perform chur together and to sing these dakini songs. And then every year they have a month where at night they go up into the cemeteries or the charnel grounds to perform chur. And they're very serious. They're very dedicated to the practices. And I think this is a very good idea. The women come together and they teach each other and they practice together and they encourage each other. And why not? So if you know girls who are interested to women who are interested, even in Tashijong, which is our lay community and monastery, the women there, only the women and not the guys, the women all come together and every year go on pilgrimage together. They've been to Sri Lanka, they've been to Bhutan, they were in Thailand, then they went somewhere else. Anyway, they're always going around together on pilgrimage as a group of women. And they have a tremendous time. They enjoy themselves and at the same time, they, you know, go to the different places and make offerings and meditate. And why not? And then they, you know, they bond with each other and encourage each other. So you can do that. I mean, the important thing is it's not anti-male. I mean, sometimes they bring one boy with them that they like very much, one nice young man, as a token male. It's not anti-male, but it's just very pro appreciating the female, that's all, which is good. I mean, as I say, everybody gains. It's not that anybody is being losing by this. Everybody is gaining by this.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Wonderful. So there's a bunch of different questions that have the same theme here. So I'll read one from Kathleen. How can we reduce the patriarchy and hierarchy that has come to us in the West with the lineage? Some in the West actually resist that, seeming to think those are important parts of the lineage, especially in relation to guru devotion. So what's your comments on that?
Oh, yes, guru devotion. I mean, you know, right now, of course, this is a very controversial subject. Mm-hmm. My feeling personally is that if one has a guru, a lama, who is genuine and really is the embodiment of Buddha nature, then that is indeed, through our devotion, a special quick path. As Trungpa Rinpoche himself said, it's like if you have a corridor with two doors at each end, the guru's door is always open. Whether or not your door is open is up to you through your devotion. So yes, if the guru is worthy of being a guru, and does not exploit his position, then that is devotion. It can be a very swift path. And all the texts agree that through meditation, you may or may not get it. Through devotion, you will. And I think that this is something which we should not throw out the baby with the bathwater. I think that the devotion to the Lama, not to the person of the Lama, but to what he embodies is very important. And that is always understood in that you know, when you visualize the Lama, you do not see the Lama as they look, but you see them in idealized form as like Guru Rinpoche or Samantabhadra, Vajradhara, so that we don't get attached to the personality and the body. You know, oh, he's so cute. You know, when he smiles, he has dimples. Or, you know, oh, that the guru is very charismatic. I mean, that's not the point. The point is, does he embody all the qualities of the Buddha that we are seeking to attain or not? And it's not easy to know, because for many people, they only see the guru sitting up on a high throne wearing his hat. How are you to know what he's like behind the scenes? So it's a double-edged sword. It's a gamble. And as I say, if the guru is worthy of being a guru, and it's not easy to know, but if you get lucky, then that can be a great blessing, no doubt, no doubt. A very, very great blessing for realizing the nature of the mind. But in general, I would say that people should be cautious. Don't believe all the publicity. I mean, even the texts themselves say that one should, you know, test the guru up to 12 years. Well, you know, maybe not that long, but we shouldn't be credulous. We should not be naive. If you are asked to do something which you really feel you've got red lights flashing inside, you can say no. That does not break your samaya. If you say, sorry, no, I can't do that. Be sensible. But there's no doubt that devotion is a very important part of the Vajrayana path. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Karma? Turn your
yes. Mood. Yes, Jitana, if I may add, because this guru topic is a hot issue these days. Don't you think that sometimes there is too much stress and focus being given on a singular guru? Now, if you look at the history of Buddhism, most of the great masters had dozens and dozens of gurus. They had so many Kalyana Mitras, these virtuous friends. There was no singular focus on one personality. And what we have today, even a kind of a misuse of the word Tsawe Lama, root guru, as being the singular sort of guru which you follow almost in a cultish manner. Wouldn't it help if we actually have many gurus and diffuse that attention? And also in terms of understanding root guru, I think technically in the text, the root guru is one who transmits the teachings directly to you, and the lineage gurus are the ones who transmits sort of to the guru in the past. So it's not necessarily that you need to have one single root guru as your personal guru, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, like the Dalai Lama says, he has 25 gurus upon his refuge tree. Someone recently I heard said he had 40 lamas upon his refuge tree. And I mean, usually you have one or two that are special, but nonetheless, exactly that. I mean, if you hear that somebody is giving some good teaching or that they have some speciality which they're really good at, then people would go to them and learn from them. And then, you know, indeed see them as their Kalyana Mitra. Yes, that's a very important point, Karma. That's really a very important point. Because when they go to the West, especially, the lamas tend to become very territorial. And they even tell people they cannot go to any other lama. It will confuse you, they say. But actually, it's just so they don't lose their student base. And yeah, that's not good. It becomes, as you say, a cult. even between lineages. I mean, my second Sari Lama after Khamtu Rinpoche is Sakya Trizin, the previous Sakya Trizin. And I would go from Khamtu Rinpoche to Sakya Trizin, and he would give presents and letters to offer to Sakya Trizin. Then I would stay with Sakya Trizin. Then when I left to come back to Khamtu Rinpoche, he would give presents and letters back to Khamtu Rinpoche. I mean, neither side ever said, no, 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 you can't do that. You know, I mean, it didn't, I think, even come into their mind to think like that. And so, you know, you would go, if I needed to get teaching on something, Rinpoche would say, go to this Lama. He's very good at that. You should go to that Lama, ask him from me. I give you a letter. You ask him to give you this teaching. And in this way, yeah, exactly. They were very open and encouraging that you should get the fullness of knowledge from as many sources as possible. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a very good point.
Thank you so much.
Marcus, shall we continue to questions or shall we end the session? Because it's already 4:15.
I think, this is a perfect place to end. If there's any final comments or thoughts you'd like to share.
Yeah, I have a final question for Jitsun Ma, and that is regarding our current situation. Almost 2 years now, we have been going through these really difficult times of the COVID pandemic. Many places have been affected. A lot of people are depressed and down because of lockdowns, because of economic difficulties. So when you come across such circumstances, there is a practice of turning misfortunes into the path. So what would you advise people to do, or what have you been doing to turn this COVID situation into a catalyst for spiritual transformation, and not just spiritual transformation, general human flourishing? If you have any advice for the audience.
Well, you know, honestly and truthfully, this is samsara. And the Buddha never said that samsara is a joyride. And we also are experiencing the results of our own actions. This is our own karma coming back to us. And so resenting it, being angry, being depressed, being frustrated, just adds more negativity in a world which is already completely paranoid. And so I think it's very important to what the world needs is positive thinking, not more negative thinking. And so rather than sit there feeling depressed, upset, frightened, or anxious, we should sit there and generate lots of loving kindness, compassion, maybe do some Tonglen practices, or just send out love to the world, light to the world, joy to the world, and to recognize that, you know, this resisting just adds more problems on top of the problems there already are. Everything depends on our own inner response, our own inner attitude to what happens to us. And if we just get upset and angry and frightened, then that's a double whammy. On top of the external problems, we have the internal problems, which doesn't make sense at all. So the point is, therefore, to send out and to recognize that, you know, this is samsara. I mean, I don't know why people are so surprised. You know, no, samsara is not secure. No, samsara does not go the way I want it to go. It is going to go the way it's going to go. And what we have charge of is our own inner landscape, our own inner attitude to what is happening to us. So I would say just, you know, include in your practice lots of in visualizing the whole planet being filled with light and love and goodness, and to counteract all this heavy negative psychic pollution which is enveloping the world, not just physical pollution, but psychic pollution, which has been generated, of course, by the media and the governments and so forth. So don't plug into that energy. Plug into a positive energy. Plug into our Buddha nature. No matter how much pollution there may be, it can never affect our Buddha nature, which is always pure love and luminosity and intelligence. Send that out into the world to ignite others' innate goodness.
Thank you, Jisunma. That's a wonderful, wonderful concluding message. Plug into the Buddha nature and send out love and light to the rest of the world. Thank you. Thank you for joining us and sharing your wisdom and experience. And I hope you'll come back again in the future. And
well,
also thank
you. Come to Bhutan in the future. Are you usually there?
I am mostly here, Jisunma. We would welcome you. So do please come. And yes, to all the audience as well, thank you for joining us from wherever you are in the world. And do take this message of plugging into Buddha nature to your heart. And also use the online Buddha nature resource if you need to find anything more on Buddha nature. And thank you, Marcus, for organizing
all
this.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Also,
thank you,
everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.